Thank you for the introduction. My talk today will be about C#, and I will tell you how we can detect redundant compilation operations with the technique of AST hashing. And this is joint work together with the University of Erlangen-Nuremberg and the Leibniz University Hannover. So we all know the situation. We start to work on a new project. We download our source base, and we compile it for the first time. And it takes an awful lot of time to compile it, so we drink a little coffee and do a little bit of sword fighting. And after that, we do some modification to our source base and recompile the whole project. And again, this takes time. It's considerably faster, but it still takes time. And you repeat this cycle. You modify the source code, you recompile, and you do this over and over again. You get so annoyed by this that you would even accept a Usenix paper on it. So the problem is not that we spend time on compiling, but the problem is that we spend time on recompiling. So how does the world look in C and C++? So that's what we focused on. Their recompilation is done on the granularity of compilation units. Since we have no proper module system in C and C++, in C++ not yet, the compilation is done on compilation unit basis. So compilation unit normally consists of a single source file and includes some interfaces from other modules by including the text of some other header. So the compilation of this particular module depends not only on the source code, but also on the headers that are included. And these dependencies are then encoded in the build system. So here we have a small fragment of a makefile where the developer encoded, yeah, when you want to recompile to build this compilation unit, network.o, it depends on network.c, network.h, and types.h. And make then, when it's instructed to do a recompile, it looks at those three files. Is any of this file newer than network.o, and network.o is existing? Then we have to invoke the compiler. So if all the files are older, nothing has changed, then we're fine, we don't invoke the compiler. So make doesn't timestamp-based detection of redundant build operations. But perhaps this is not the best way to do it, since when you do an edit in the types.h file, and it's a very central file that is included by many compilation units, you get the problem that you have to recompile a lot of compilation units, although the result of these compilation units might not necessarily change. So the question is, we want to detect that the result of the compilation unit will be the same as the last time we run the compiler. So where is the time spent in our compilation? So in this graphic, we see the different GCC optimization levels from 0, no optimization, to 0.3, where we do a lot of optimization. And the bars are divided by the phases of the compiler where we spend the time. So we spend time in the C preprocessor, in the C parser, and the rest is normally spent in the optimization level. So the higher our optimization is, the more time we spend on the optimization. And when we do detect redundant recompilations, we intercept at some point and show, okay, the input hasn't changed, so the result will be the same. So where does make and the timestamp-based approach fit into this picture? It is at the beginning, it avoids the whole invocation of the compiler at all. So we can save the whole bar when make detects, yeah, all the source files are older than the actual .o file, so we don't have to invoke the compiler at all. The problem is this is a little bit coarse-grained, as I've already explained. An edit in a central header file can lead to many compilations, recompilations, also nothing has really changed. So when we add a comment or something like that. Another approach to do this is to take a little bit more time and to do the parsing and then build an MD5 sum over the output of the C preprocessor. And this is what C-cache is already doing. It intercepts after the C preprocessor and does a textual hash over the output of the C preprocessor and then looks up with this key in its internal cache, is there already an object file for that cache, then just reuse the object file and we're good. So where does C#hash fit into this picture? We spend a little bit more time during the compiler invocation. We do not only the C preprocessor, but we also do the C parser, such that we can abstract from the actual source code onto the semantic level, and we calculate a semantic hash of our compilation unit. And in a nutshell, what we do, we calculate a hash after the parser and then compare the hash to the last invocation. If it hasn't changed, we just stop the compilation. So what is the rest of the outline of my talk? I first want to explain to you the general approach, how we hash the abstract syntax tree. And then we do two evaluations, one with minimal changes and one with commit size changes, and then we come to a conclusion. Okay, so how does it look within the compiler when we spend a little bit more time on our compilation unit? So after the C preprocessor, we start our parser, and the first thing we get is that we get an actual tree for our source code. So on the bottom, we see what was the input to our parser. We have the struct definitions, we have empty struct definitions, we have some other types, and we have a function definition where there are two statements. When we parse this, we first get an actual tree. In this picture, we avoided the DOP level node, since otherwise the graph would be a little bit unreadable. So, and after the parser, the next step that is done is the semantic analysis. So we still, at this stage, don't know whether this is a correct C program or not. So we do the semantic analysis and annotate all the nodes with its type and also add references to variable definitions. So where does a variable come from, what is its type, and so on. And basically, with this semantic analysis, our nice abstract syntax tree becomes a directed graph. And there can even be cycles in our directed graph here, since there can be recursive type definitions. For example, the struct unused, it contains a field to and pointer on its own type. So we even can have cycles in this, and we have to work with this. Awesome. Okay. What do we want to do with this semantically enriched AST? For a single compilation unit, we want to calculate a semantic fingerprint of this. We do this by starting at the top level node of our directed graph and say, okay, we want to include the hashes of all the definitions that can influence the actual output of the compilation. So we hash the function definitions and the global variable definitions, but we avoid to start the hashing at global type definitions. We only include types when they are referenced within some definition. And when we revisit a single node, we do not only include the fields of the node, but also we include the hashes of all its referenced nodes. So in this example, for A, we not only include the fields of A, but also 23 and 42, which are the hash values for its referenced nodes. And as I've already told you, this semantically enriched AST can have cycles within it. It can have multiple paths to the same node. And therefore, we cache and reuse hash values for nodes that we've already visited. And when we encounter an actual cycle, for example, in this struct unused case, we abort the recursion by using a surrogate hash value, for example, here the struct unused field. In struct unused, there we use the name of the field and a string representation of the type to not go in an endless recursion with our depth-first search. So how does this look for our example? We want to calculate the hash value for top-level definition of function inc. So we only start there. We don't start at the record ref count, since this is a type declaration. So we in the first place, we are not interested in this. A type cannot influence the outcome of the compilation unless it is used. And then we start with our depth first search and go down, for example, to the record object type. And there we apply, in this example, a very simplistic hashing method. So actually, in our implementation, we use an improper hash, but to simplify things, in the example, we just add for every node a 2 for the blue boxes, a 1 for the green, and a 3 for the expressions, the yellow ones. And the children are just added up. So we start at a hash value for this record object, contains no field, has the hash value of 2. Then we retreat from our depth first search, and we see that the pointer to this object record has a hash value of 4. This is 2 plus 2, one from the child, one from the type. and our object field has a value of 6. Then we do the rest of this type part, and we see now we have hash values for the function type, so of the signature of the function of 18, but we also have an already calculated an value for this pointer object. And we will reuse this hash value when we re-encounter it again afterwards when we come from this argument E node, that we reuse this 14 in our hash value. Then we descend in the actual definition of the function, calculate the hash values in the same manner, and we end up with two values, 18 and 75, for the top level. We add them up together and add the 1 for our function inc node. And by this, we have a hash value for this definition function inc. When we have a translation unit, we add them further up to the single compilation unit node, the one at the top, and this represents the semantic fingerprint of our whole compilation unit. And as you see, we haven't visited this record unused in this example. And however this is structured, it cannot influence the actual outcome of the hash value. So we can ignore changes to this record. The next thing we have done, we've implemented this as a Clang plugin. And this Clang plugin calculates the hash value. It reads the hash value from the last invocation, if it is there. And then we have two hash values. We have an old hash value, a new hash value. We compare those hash values to each other. If it hasn't changed, we simply call exit in our compiler. We also have to update the timestamp of the compilation result, the .o file, and then we are good. If the hash values don't match, we simply proceed with our compilation. And this is really, so with C#, we presented a method to hash the data structure that is already within the compiler. How we get the result from the last compilation is kind of orthogonal. So other methods like C#, employ much more complex caching mechanisms. C#, has a fixed size cache where it stores pairs of fingerprints and object files. For C#, we just use a history of one, only stored the last variant, but we can freely combine our fingerprinting with the actual caching strategy. Good, let's now come to an evaluation, first with minimal and incremental modifications, and how would the setting look like in reality? So the setting we want to mimic here is a developer that sits down and does a minimal modification to an already built source file and then issues make to rebuild the whole project. And we've done this evaluation by taking 6 different open source projects ranging from small to larger ones, and they have 3 different build systems, and we start always from a fully built source base where all the object files are updated, where all the executables are already linked, and we keep this timestamp-based dependency checking of the build system in place, so we use it as it is supposed to be, this build system. Since we are a compiler plugin, we are orthogonal to the actual build system. And we compare our approach baseline, C#, or C#. And what we actually do, we look at each source file in our repository, in each header, and we make a minimal modification that surely does not influence the outcome of the compilation, for example, update a timestamp, or introduce a useless texture change, which is not that easy. And then we start the build system and measure the time, how long it takes to rebuild the whole repository. We do this for every source file. So how does the results look like? In this presentation, only can we present you the introduction of the useless textual change. This is the best case scenario for C#. In the paper, I also present you the update timestamp. This is where C# is actually helping. Okay, so how does it look like? The problem with C# is we introduced a textual change to our source space, so C# is really not able to detect that the outcome of the compilation will be the same, and therefore we have even to pay the overhead of maintaining the cache and the calculating of the MD5 sum. For Zhash, we see that for 4 projects, our savings range from 40 to 60%. So this is really, really good. But for 2 projects, we also see that our savings are not that large. So this is for MuzzleLibC and the embed TLS crypto library. And the problem we have there is that the structure of the source code, of the dependency structure, is so that it is very shallow. So, and the compilation unit doesn't really depend on many, many header files. So when we change a file, we only invoke a single compiler invocation and not many compiler invocations, since when we touch a header file. And therefore, we can save only the optimization phase of a single compiler invocation, and the time is dominated by the actual linking phase that comes after that. Good. So our second evaluation, we used commit-sized modifications to mimic a different scenario. So the scenario we want to mimic is a build server that receives commits from its developers and continually builds these commits. And the difference is a commit in a source code repository is much more coarse-grained. It's the condensed work of a developer over a few hours. So this is where we will see more not redundant build operations. So what we do, we took our 6 open source projects and built the last 500 non-merge commits. And for every commit, we prepared the source tree by fully building its parent commit. Therefore, we used non-merge hashes, non-merge commits, that it is unique which one we want to choose. And we compare baseline to using Zcash in the scenario, to using plain Zhash, and to combining both Zcash and Zhash by chaining it after each other. So when Zcash says, okay, I found the object file in the cache, the compiler and Zhash is not invoked, and Zhash then captures everything that Zcash couldn't capture. And this we do for every commit, and then record the rebuild times. So in the resource table, we first see that from our 500 commits in the source code repository, not every commit is actually building. We ignore the non-buildable commits. For Bash, there are only 128 commits to start with, so there's not a long version history in the Git repository, and therefore only 108 commits are building. On the right, we see the savings compared to the baseline, and I've always highlighted which variant really is the best for this particular project. So Zcash is best for the MuzzleLibC. And this is the problem that I already explained with the special structure of the source code, where the dependency graph is really, really shallow, and the compilation unit mainly depends only on the C file. For 3 other projects, we see that Zcash alone really, really shines, and we can improve the savings by 20%, for example, for Postgres SQL. In 2 other cases, we see that the combination of Zcash and Zhash is even better than one of the approaches alone, and we can get savings up to 53% for CPython. On average, we can say that Zcash aborts 61% of all compiler invocations and finds the result in the cache, and Zhash finds 80% and aborts 80% of the compiler invocation, although Zcash doesn't have a deep cache like Zhash has. I'm sorry about the names, yeah, so my fault. Okay, so Zhash doesn't really have a deep cache, and although we don't have a deep cache, we can abort 80% of the compilation, so this is really, really nice. And the average compilation speed up, Zcash, although it's doing less work, saves 24%, and with Zhash, we can save about 30% on average. So now I come to a conclusion. What is Zhash? Zhash is a method to hash the abstract syntax tree to detect redundant build operations, and by this we can not only exclude purely syntactical changes, like adding a comment, but we also can exclude changes to types that are never referenced. So this is really nice, especially when you have many of your implementation in a header. C-hash improves not only the recompilation times for an individual developer, but it's also usable for build farms, it is build system agnostic, and it's combinable with other detection mechanisms to find redundant build operations like timestamps or the textual hash as employed in C-cache. As a future work for C-hash, we plan to integrate this mechanism into mainline compilers, GCC and Clang, at least the hashing part. So this abort compilation is not necessarily useful for every scenario, but at least the hashing part would be really nice to have in the mainline compilers. You could also do some partial recompilation. You could stop the hashing to the top at the function definition level. Then you have a fingerprint for a single function definition. You can say, oh, that function implementation hasn't changed since the last compilation. We just don't recompile and optimize it. And I really want to see how this works for more complex languages. So we've only done this for C. And for other languages, the importance of header is even more. And C++ comes to mind, where people are implementing half their program in a header in the template. So there we really should see better savings than for C. So thank you for your attention. And I'm now happy to answer all your questions.
Hi, this is really interesting work. I haven't read the paper, but I assume that the hash function you use is different than the one you presented, just for the sake of simplicity.
Yeah, of course. So we used an MUMU3 hash, and this is a non-cryptographical hash, since we don't want to defend against an evil attacker, but it's a little bit more efficient than using a cryptographical hash like SHA-1 or a proper hash that is not broken.
So my question was, you know, have you evaluated different hash functions? Sounds like you have, to trade off between possibility of collision versus maximum efficiency.
No, we haven't done that. The thing is, the hashing really doesn't take long. So we are about a few milliseconds to traverse over the est, and traversing over the whole tree is done in compilers over and over again until the immediate representation is there. So this is a rather common operation.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Arthur, UTH Zurich. Nice stuff. I was just wondering, and this may be a bizarre question, in the last few years, both LLVM and GCC have introduced some interesting optimizations where they figure out whether a statement's behavior is technically undefined in the C standard, and if so, they can successfully optimize out all the code that follows it, regardless of whether or not the programmer expects that stuff to work. And so I'm wondering whether, excluding, unreferenced declarations interacts with those kinds of perhaps slightly over-aggressive optimizations in a useful way or in a negative way, or have you encountered that problem?
No. So the thing is, when a type is never referenced, it cannot have an influence on the outcome. It only can be put in, for example, the debug output, but it is never used within the actual binary code that is emitted. So it cannot have an influence on the outcome.
All right, so the declarations, they're just types. They're not declarations of unused variables and things like that.
No, that would be in definition. So,
right.
Yeah, so we only exclude declarations like this variable is defined somewhere else, but when there is an actual allocation in the ELF binary for that object, we have to include it in the hash. Mm. And we are also very conservative about what we put into the hash. So we also hash names, although they don't necessarily have an influence on the binary. But just to be on the safe side and don't try to be too smart, we just hash almost everything that is important for a single node. You really don't want to break this. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't break. So be conservative about it.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Hi, Virendra Marathi, Oracle Labs. Awesome talk. Thanks.
Thank you.
I had a question about changes that are just related to reordering statements in the program. Will they have any effect at all at the hashes that are computed? And in that case,
So we hash the statements in the order they are coming. So when we switch the order, a different hash will appear.
Oh, great,
thanks. Reordering the statements would again be too smart.